I've been, that's one of them. We'll be recording this call today. I'll just say that first. So the people who join us right now can call in and listen later. And we've done that for other teleseminars, and we'll be posting the phone number and the dial-in information on our website. The second thing is that we ask you to mute your phone if you haven't done so already, especially if you're on a cell phone, as background noise from one phone can make it very difficult for everyone to hear. You can mute and unmute by pressing 4-star. Also, I just want to let you know on the call is Lou Giesel, our president-elect of ACR, and he will be handling the Q&A, as I unfortunately will need to drop off the call towards the end, so he'll go ahead and do that. First, I know that the announcement has gone out far and wide for this teleseminar, so if you're new to ACR, I just want to quickly let you know we're a membership organization comprised of several thousand conflict resolution practitioners and scholars working in virtually all sectors of society, and you're welcome to go to our website to learn about our organization. It's www.acrnet.org. That's also on the announcement that went out. And also just be sure to look at our conference information. Our annual conference is in Chicago, September 1 to 4. And given the topic today, I'd encourage you to look specifically on the website at our international section, and then also for the conference, if you can look at International Day. Today's topic, the Supreme Court decision Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project, is one that we as an organization really want to learn about, and we feel our members should understand its potential impact fully. We on the board have been engaging in discussion around this Supreme Court decision. We have not yet taken a particular stance on the subject. We are learning more about it and exploring whether we should and what that stance might be. And if you have questions or comments about that, please feel free to email us. You can email the staff, and they'll forward your email to the appropriate board member. Their email addresses are on the website. Also, just another resource, if you're really interested in the subject and interested in the reform bill, which is currently pending in Congress, is the Charity and Security Network, and they're very deeply involved in this, and their website was one of the links on the announcement for this teleseminar. So today we are delighted to have with us Georgetown Law Professor David Cole, who's the attorney who represented Humanitarian Law Project for the last 12 years and who's argued their case before the Supreme Court. We so appreciate his willingness to do this teleseminar on such short notice. Right after the decision was announced, I sent him an email probably 4 days after the decision came out, and he very quickly responded and agreed to this call. So we're very grateful for that. Professor Cole is a Yale Law graduate. He clerked for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit and has published widely. He's received numerous awards for his civil rights and civil liberties work, including one from the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of the Freedom of Expression, the American Bar Association's Individual Rights and Responsibilities section, the National Lawyers Guild, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, and many others. And you can read his full bio on the announcement or on the Georgetown Law Center website. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Professor David Cole.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks to all of you who have joined in. I would prefer to be talking about a case that I won rather than a case that I lost, but this is the world that we live in. So I think one of the ways to understand the material support law, which was at issue in the Humanitarian Law Project case, is to compare it to the anti-communist laws of the McCarthy period. You know, at that time in the 40s, 50s, 60s, there was a great fear in the country that communism would undermine our way of life, and that the Communist Party in particular was an international conspiracy backed by the second most powerful country in the world, armed with nuclear arms, and set out to overthrow our government and our way of life by force and violence. And And in fact, Congress made specific findings to that effect. And because of this great fear of communism, Congress enacted very broad anti-communist laws that targeted not simply the act of seeking to overthrow the United States by force and violence or the act of terrorism, which Congress found the Communist Party employed, or the acts of sabotage, which Congress also found the Communist Party employed, but also any affiliation or association with the Communist Party and any speech advocating communist ideas. And the argument was not that the speech and the association were themselves somehow dangerous, that the mere fact that someone spoke, advocated communist ideas, or that someone was a member of the Communist Party was somehow going to threaten harm to anybody else, but rather it was a preventive argument. The argument was the Communist Party is an entity which poses a great threat to us. Any support of that party ultimately will support its illegal ends. Those illegal ends are sufficiently grave that we need to prevent them from coming to pass, and the way we do that is by criminalizing speech and association. And indeed, for the entire period of the sort of the McCarthy era, that is before he was censored by the Senate, the courts did not really rein in these efforts. They allowed these kinds of guilt by association and criminalization of speech to go forward in the name of preventing communism. Today, we don't make it a crime to be a member of a political organization, whether that organization be communist or terrorist. And there's actually strong case law establishing that it is your First Amendment right to advocate even illegal activity, even overthrow of the United States by force and violence. And so we don't have laws that, for the most part, directly criminalize speech advocating terrorism. But in the material support law, Congress has effectively resurrected those tactics, the tactic of guilt by association and of penalizing speech, by renaming it, relabeling it, material support for a terrorist group. So the law, which was enacted in 1996 as part of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, a year after the Oklahoma City bombing of the federal building, gives the Secretary of State the power to declare certain foreign groups foreign terrorist organizations. And the Secretary essentially has largely has a kind of blank check in so designating groups. There are criteria, but the criteria are that the group has to be foreign, that the group has to have engaged in terrorist activity, but then that is in turn defined very broadly to include any use of a weapon to endanger person or property. So it's extremely broad. I mean, most gangs would be terrorist groups, et cetera. And then the third criterion is that the group's activities threaten the United States' national security, foreign policy, or economic interests, which is itself very broad, and the courts have held that that last criterion is not reviewable by the courts. So there are probably thousands of organizations around the world that have used a weapon against person or property at one point. Any of them could be designated as a foreign terrorist organization, and as long as it's foreign and it has used such a tactic at one point or another, it can be designated. The Secretary of State has actually designated 45 groups thus far as foreign terrorist organizations. There is, however, as I imagine many people on the call know, a similar law which gives the Secretary of the Treasury the power to designate organizations and individuals as specially designated global terrorists under an executive order issued by President Bush right after September 11th. And under that list, which is a separate list but has very similar prohibitions on it, you're not permitted to provide any kind of material support to a group or individual on this list. There are hundreds and hundreds of pages long, and there are several thousand individuals and organizations on that list. Similarly, similar broad discretion to the executive branch to put individuals and organizations on that list. So the law works by giving the government the power to put groups on a sort of blacklist, designated foreign terrorist organizations, and then makes it a crime for anyone in the United States or any U.S. person, a person who is a U.S. citizen but lives abroad, or anyone who is otherwise subject to U.S. jurisdiction, to provide material support to such an organization. And material support is in turn defined broadly to include not just money and explosives and things like that, but also speech in the form of expert advice or training or service, which the government has defined as anything that one does for a group that provides it some benefit. So very, very broad indeed. And the law requires that the aid be given with knowledge that the recipient is in fact a foreign terrorist organization, but not with intent that the aid further any of its illegal ends. So the government has to prove that the donor knew that the organization either was on the list or engaged in terrorist activity. But it does not have to prove that the aid was provided for any unlawful use. So humanitarian aid is just as much a crime as sending explosives. And the argument is much the same as it was during the Communist Party era, that these terrorist organizations are bad groups. They engage in terrible and illegal and violent conduct. Any support to the groups ultimately strengthens them and allows them to engage in more terrorist activity. And so we need to cut off all support to the groups. The law does make an exception for medicine and religious materials, but the other law, which I referred to earlier, that gives the Secretary of the Treasury the power to designate groups, does not make an exception for medicine and religious materials. So the exception is largely ineffectual, because while you would not be prosecuted for providing material support under the material support law if you gave medicine to one of these groups, you could be prosecuted under the parallel law that the Secretary of the Treasury oversees. So that's the law. It's the citation for it is 18 U.S.C. section 2339B. I represented a group of plaintiffs. The principal plaintiffs were Ralph Fertig, a retired federal administrative law judge, and the Humanitarian Law Project, a 20 to 30-year-old humanitarian law organization headquartered in Los Angeles. Ralph Fertig was the president of its board. And what the Humanitarian Law Project did was go to various conflict-ridden regions of the world and encourage the participants in the disputes to, number one, understand and abide by humanitarian law, the law of laws of war, and number two, seek out alternative avenues, peaceful, lawful avenues for resolving their disputes and their grievances. And specifically, they had been, prior to this law's enactment, been working in Turkey on behalf of the Kurds, seeking to support the Kurds' efforts to protect their human rights. And they worked with, among others, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is the, or at least was, may still be the sort of leading political representative of the Kurds in Turkey. And they, specifically what they did was they taught the Kurds how to bring human rights complaints in Geneva. They worked with them and helped them in bringing such complaints in Geneva. They facilitated peace talks and peace overtures working alongside the Kurds and the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Once this law was enacted in 1996, and then the Kurdistan Workers' Party was designated as a foreign terrorist organization in 1997, it became a crime for the Humanitarian Law Project to continue to engage in this activity, or at least it appeared to make it a crime, because the law defines material support to include any training, any expert advice, any service, any personnel, and training the group to bring human rights complaints or advising them on human rights and humanitarian law or working with them in a peace negotiation would be seen as expert advice or training or service, all material support. And it's no defense under the law that the purpose, that Ralph Furtick's purpose was not to further terrorism, but in fact to discourage terrorism by encouraging lawful, peaceful, nonviolent alternative avenues. So we brought that case in 1997, and we were successful for more than a decade in the lower courts. The courts consistently ruled that the provisions in the material support definition that applied to speech were unconstitutional because they were so broad and because they would make it a crime, for example, to teach international law or to work towards peace. The Obama administration appealed the case to the Supreme Court, and as I take it everyone on the call knows, the Supreme Court reversed and ruled that the law, as applied to this specific kind of speech, that is speech advocating peace and speech advocating human rights and training for how to bring human rights claims and working with a group in trying to pursue peace, constitutes material support under the law and is a crime and does not violate the First Amendment right of free speech or free association in doing so. The court's reasoning was interesting. It acknowledged that this was at least as applied here, it was a content-based prohibition of pure speech. The government had argued that this was not a content-based regulation of speech, but rather a neutral prohibition on the conduct of providing aid to groups, and therefore the court need not review the law using the kind of skeptical scrutiny that it employs when it reviews regulations of speech, but should instead use a very deferential approach that it employs when laws regulate conduct that only incidentally affect expression. That was the government's argument. The government didn't even try to defend the statute under the sort of traditional standard of scrutiny that applies to the regulation of speech. It just said it wasn't a regulation of speech. On that issue, we won. The court unanimously held that this was a regulation of speech. It was a content-based regulation of speech, and therefore strict scrutiny should apply. Usually, once you get to that point in litigation, you have won the case, because it is very, very rare indeed that a law satisfies strict scrutiny. Law professor, Gerald Gunther from Stanford, famously called this test strict in theory, fatal in fact, because so few laws have ever survived strict scrutiny. But this one did. And what Chief Justice Roberts said was, yes, it's a regulation of speech. Yes, it has to satisfy strict scrutiny, which requires that the government show that it is that these means, that is, prohibiting speech, advocating peace and human rights, are necessary or narrowly tailored to further a compelling government interest. And nobody disputed that there's a compelling government interest in discouraging terrorism, but our argument was that it's not necessary or narrowly tailored to that end, to make it a crime to encourage groups to avoid terrorism and pursue lawful means. And Chief Justice Roberts said, no, it is necessary and narrowly tailored for the following reasons. One, even if the support that our clients are providing might would not directly lead to violence, it might legitimate the group. The mere fact that the group is seen bringing a human rights complaint in Geneva might legitimate the group in the eyes of the public, might burnish its image. It would then be able to be more successful going out and raising money. It could then use that money to engage in terrorist activity. He also reasoned that if you teach it how to use the law to further human rights, it will then, there's a risk that it will use the law to, in his words, intimidate, harass, and disrupt. And then third, he reasoned that if you work with it in encouraging peace, it might use peace talks as a cover to rearm itself for further attacks. Now, there are two things that were sort of surprising about this. One is that the latter two arguments were not even made by the government. The government didn't say that, you know, teaching people about peace would give groups the ability to use this as a cover, nor did it say that teaching people to use the law will, you know, allow them to intimidate, harass, and disrupt. So the court just made up those arguments for the government. Ordinarily, in strict scrutiny, it doesn't do that. And the second thing that's troubling is that the government offered no evidence that this sort of support had ever, in fact, led to these sorts of results. And the court didn't, and ordinarily the court requires very strong evidence that the alleged evil will, in fact, follow from the conduct that is prohibited. In this case, the court said, well, the government's goal here is preventive, and therefore we're not going to require it to put forward any evidence that shows that these things have actually come to pass. And so it upheld the law as applied to this type of speech. So what does this mean going forward for peace groups and conflict resolution groups and humanitarian aid groups and the like? Well, it means that the government has a very, very broad sort of free hand to put organizations on these lists and to then make it a crime for anyone to really have anything to do with these groups, because material support is written so broadly that almost any kind of advice, any kind of teaching, any kind of advocacy done in coordination with the group will be prohibited, can be prohibited, and can be prosecuted, and the individual can face a 15-year prison sentence. So under this statute, the Obama administration argued in the Supreme Court that it would be a crime to file an amicus brief in the Supreme Court on behalf of a designated group, for example, in our case, arguing that the statute was unconstitutional. Under the government's view of this statute, it was a crime when President Carter went to Lebanon in 2009 to monitor the elections, because as part of the election monitoring, he met with each of the parties to the election and advised them based on his expertise as to what one should look for in a fair election, and what he would be looking for, and how they should disport themselves. And in so doing, he met with, among others, Hezbollah, because it is a legitimate political party in Lebanon with representatives in the legislature. But Hezbollah is a terrorist organization on the list. And so by providing his expert advice to Hezbollah, he was committing the crime of providing material support. Similarly, under this law, when the New York Times, the Washington Post, and that President Carter, the Carter Center, signed on to a very, very good amicus brief filed by the ACLU on behalf of a variety of peace groups, including the Carter Center, the International Crisis Group, the Notre Dame, and several other university-based conflict resolution centers, arguing that this law should be struck down because of the effect it has on peace groups. The court was not persuaded. The law is so broad that when the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times in recent years published op-eds by Hamas spokespersons, they were committing the crime of providing material support, because editing that op-ed and putting it in such an influential publication is providing a service of benefit to Hamas, and therefore they could have been prosecuted under this law. Lawyers or others who work with refugees who disclosed that they were members of an organization, a militant organization, could be prosecuted as well for providing material support in the form of expert advice to those refugees. So it's a very broad law, very disturbing in its applications. In terms of the effects it will have going forward, I think there's there are a number. I mean, sort of the most direct result is that for those organizations and individuals who are either risk-averse or advised by risk-averse lawyers, and that might be redundant, will not engage with groups that are on the list. And as was pointed out in a very excellent – in an excellent op-ed in the New York Times written by Robert Axelrod and Scott Atran on June 30th, 2010, and I highly recommend you look it up on the web, they argue that this is really self-defeating, because the way that one transforms a terrorist group away from resort to violence is precisely by engaging with the moderate elements within the group. There's almost always, these groups almost always have moderate and more extreme elements, and if one engages with the moderate elements and supports them and shows that they can make more progress through lawful nonviolent means, then that is a way of moving the group away from violence, reducing violence, and marginalizing extremists. But this law makes no distinction between those who seek to engage with these groups for those purposes and those who, you know, seek to engage with these groups to teach them how to build a bomb. I think it will also have a chilling effect on fundraising for any groups that work in conflict-ridden regions, because people will be afraid that their donations will somehow render them vulnerable to this law. I don't think that they will. I don't think people should be reticent about supporting conflict resolution groups and humanitarian aid foundations that work in conflict-ridden regions. But the nature of the chilling effect is that oftentimes a law that makes what seems to be legitimate activity suspect deters many people from engaging in what actually is fully legitimate activity. The reason I don't think it's actually that donors should not be concerned by such a law is that the law makes it a crime to provide material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. That's the crime, providing support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. So if you're not providing, if you're making a donation to a humanitarian aid group or to a conflict resolution group, or indeed to any group that is not designated, that is not on the list, you are not in danger of violating this law as it's written, unless you are providing aid to the conflict resolution group or to the humanitarian aid group for the purpose of having that aid go to a proscribed group. If you're doing it for that purpose, then, you know, the fact that you're using an intermediary is not a defense. But if you're just supporting the group and you don't know that it's working with a foreign terrorist organization, then that should not be a predicate for a criminal charge. What needs to be done? I think, number one, public education is critical. The kind of op-ed that was in the New York Times on June 30th by Axelrod and Atrin is really, really important. And I think had there been more awareness of the impact of this kind of law of that nature before the Supreme Court decided the case, in a broader sense, we might have the case may well have come out differently. Ultimately, this is a public education challenge. The sort of the mantra on the other side, on the government side, is money is fungible. So however you support a terrorist group, you can't know or it's inevitable that it will further the terrorist ends of the group. That's I think a very simplistic way of understanding the way the world works, and anyone who has ever studied or worked with groups engaged in militant activity knows that, in fact, that's not the case, that there are groups that have political ends. They use a variety of means towards those ends. They are not, their purpose is not to engage in terrorism or violence, and so it's not that it's not the case that supporting them in engaging in lawful, nonviolent activities will somehow inevitably further terrorism. But that's the sort of soundbite on the other side, and I think, you know, we need, on our side of this, need to underscore just how broad this law is, how it makes it a crime for the first time ever to engage in otherwise lawful speech that's advocating no violence at all. I mean, before this, as I said before, the Supreme Court has said that you have a First Amendment right to advocate violence. And yet here, they're saying that Congress can make it a crime to advocate peace. And the harm that this will do to our efforts at reducing resort to violence around the world is, I think, significant. In terms of limiting the damage, there are really two sort of options. One is...
Hi, this is Jan Schoenemann.
Hello? Yeah. One is getting Congress to act by amending the law to create safe harbors for the kinds of activities that I think most Americans would think should not be made a crime, like advocating for peace and human rights. And I think that's not I think that may be doable, maybe not in the short term, but I think in the long term. And just one historical example: the Supreme Court years ago upheld the government's right to prohibit all trade, all transactions with embargoed nations, like Cuba or Libya or Iran, et cetera, even as against people who wanted to engage in those kinds of transactions for First Amendment purposes. The Supreme Court also upheld many years ago the government's ability to keep people out of this country based on their speech, foreign nationals, deny them visas based on their speech or their associations. So, and the Supreme Court said that there was no First Amendment problem with either of those things. Yet, there then arose a coalition called the Free Trade and Ideas Coalition that worked for many years and grew increasingly broader in its ambit, and ultimately succeeded in getting Congress to enact exemptions to the trade and transaction embargo law for informational materials and communications, First Amendment types of transactions. And similarly, they were successful in enacting an amendment to the immigration law prohibiting exclusion of foreign nationals based on speech and associations that would be protected if engaged in by a U.S. citizen. And ultimately, they were successful in getting that law, the McCarran-Walter Act, the ideological exclusion law, overturned by Congress itself, repealed by Congress. So I think, you know, one can respond to a Supreme Court decision of this nature by getting Congress to sort of create carve-outs to the law. And I think that's a really, really important avenue to go down. And right now, the Charity and Security Network, which Rachel mentioned at the outset of the call, is doing both public education and working in educating members of Congress about this issue and advocating for reform that would make this would mitigate the harmful effects of this kind of law. So the Charity and Security Network, I think, is very important to try to support that and to support public education on this issue by writing op-eds and the like that point to the unintended consequences of this kind of law. There are also litigation opportunities. There are a couple of challenges right now in the courts that challenge sort of the other end of this process, the process by which groups get put on the list in the first place, which is a very, very sort of one-sided, secretive process. Thus far, a couple of courts have held that a couple of courts here in the United States have held that that process is unconstitutional. A couple of courts abroad, including the European Court of Justice and the UK Supreme Court, have held that the process violates basic human rights. Because we not only apply this law domestically, but we also got the UN to adopt a kind of international version of it, which applies around the world. And courts in Europe have held that the process by which groups get put on the list is basically unfair, doesn't provide any meaningful opportunity to defend oneself, and therefore is invalid. And as I said, there's two cases, one involving a group called Kindhearts in Ohio, and the other involving a group called Al Haramain in Portland, Oregon, that have in which district courts have held that the process here is unconstitutional. These issues will also arise in the context of specific criminal cases, and I think it's important that there be broad support through amicus briefs for, you know, making sure that this law is not read even more broadly than the government read it in the Humanitarian Law Project case. Those are the principal sort of ways to move forward. I think on an issue like this, it's important to take the long view, particularly, you know, in the wake of a loss like this, and to sort of put that in perspective. I return, you know, as I close, to the McCarthy era period. As I said, when Congress first adopted these laws criminalizing speech and association at the height of the McCarthy era, the Supreme Court did not intervene to protect speech and association. Rather, it only did so after McCarthy himself went too far, targeted the army, We had the Army McCarthy hearings, and he was censored by the Senate because he had gone too far. At that point, and only at that point, did the Supreme Court then step in and rule that the First Amendment protects speech, even if it advocates overthrow of the government, and that the First Amendment protects association with the Communist Party and allows the government to punish association with the Communist Party only if an individual is shown to have specifically intended to further the illegal ends of the group. So these principles, which we now sort of are bedrock principles of our First Amendment jurisprudence, were not recognized in the early days. And it was only after a great deal of political struggle, public education, litigation, and the like that the country and the court began to recognize the excesses that laws as broad as this create, and we began to see the pendulum shift the other way. So now I'd be happy to take questions. I think we have a moderator who's going to.
Yeah, hi, David. This is Lou Giesel with ACR. Rachel asked me to sort of open up and try and moderate the Q&A. First, let me say thank you so much for giving us so much of your time and all of this detailed information. It's extraordinarily helpful, and we feel very fortunate to be able to have scheduled this call and had the benefit of your time so quickly after the case was heard. So this is a terrific opportunity to get some very timely information. And it does seem like it's a very challenging point in our nation's constitutional history. So I feel really grateful to have had a chance to listen to you. I had a little bit of difficulty getting on the call, and I don't know if others did as well. At first, I was on the call, and I was muted and had to try several different times to be able to speak. I hope that you can hear me now and that I got past that. And I don't know whether that was the same problem that you were having at the beginning or whether other people have that challenge too. So we'll see who chimes in. I suspect there are many, many people on the call who have some questions or comments or want to chime in. And I'm not going to try and start or moderate a queue. I find that it's helpful for people to be mindful of the time and make room for one another. But for those who are unable to ask you a question, is there an email address or some other way where it would be a way for people to correspond with you?
Sure. It's Cole, C-O-L-E, at law.georgetown.edu.
Okay, and so I'll just start with a quick question. It is interesting to hark to the era of McCarthyism and to think about that, and it seems like we could also think all the way back to the witch hunts as being a parallel to what's going on here now. Well, if I understand correctly, for those of us who do some training or do work with international people or international visitors, we can only get ourselves in trouble this way if we are aware that these individuals have some connection to one of the listed organizations, which seems to create an incentive to put our heads in the sand and to not ask any questions about any international people we might run across. So I'm sort of wondering, well, what's our responsibility to do that in terms of due diligence and making sure, I just want to be sure that I have a good handle on that, and all of the people on the call do as well. What is it that we should be trying to do to protect ourselves in this?
Right. Well, the first thing I think is that there's no obligation to check, the political affiliation of every person with whom you deal. If you think about it, think of these, major corporations. Pepsi-Cola sells Pepsi around the world.
Sure.
If it sells Pepsi to someone who's on the foreign terrorist list, it's committing a crime, but only if it knows that the person is on the list. And Pepsi doesn't have to check every person to whom it sells a case of of Pepsi as to who they, you know, what they're, whether they're affiliated with some group or another. So there's no affirmative obligation that one check. The Treasury Department has issued what's called voluntary guidelines that encourages people to check. And I think where you have reason to be concerned that a entity that you are supporting or working with may be on the list, you should check the list. One could be prosecuted, I think, for deliberate indifference, sort of for closing one's eyes to what you at the same time, I think there's some there's some unclarity about what it's actually. When is it a crime to provide aid to someone? So if I'm teaching a class, and one of the students in my class is a member of the PKK or Hamas, and he tells me he's a member of the PKK or Hamas, am I suddenly committing a crime by continuing to teach the class or allowing him to be in the class? I don't think so, because I wouldn't be providing my teaching to the PKK as such or to Hamas as such. I'd be providing it to the students in my room, one of whom happens to be a member of the PKK. Similarly, if a hospital is, you know, serving sick people, and one of them happens to be a member of Hamas, I don't think that's providing aid to Hamas. I think that's providing aid to a sick person who happens to be a member of Hamas. And it is not a crime under this law to provide material support to a member of Hamas. It's a crime to provide material support to Hamas. At the same time, right, how do you provide support to Hamas except by virtue of providing support to individuals who are in one way or another associated with Hamas? And so if you're providing support to a member of Hamas for the purpose of aiding Hamas as such, so I'm teaching a class and the Hamas person in charge of international law advocacy comes to take my class and tells me he's taking the class so that he can advocate on behalf of Hamas, then I might be seen as providing aid to Hamas itself. So I guess, you know, three points there. One, no affirmative obligation to check. Two, if you have reason to be suspicious, you probably should check, and I think you could be prosecuted for deliberate indifference, even if you didn't affirmatively know. But that case has not yet been brought, as far as I know. And then third, the crime is providing support to the group, not merely to a member of the group.
Thank you for that. So others on the line, hopefully at this point, have been able to become unmuted and can ask a question or make a comment.
Hi, this is Joan Bernstein from Nonviolent Peace Force, and I have two questions. Thank you very much. This is a very helpful presentation. My first question is, let's say one is accompanying another party to this conflict that is not on the list, and in advocating for something that the other, to be helpful to the other party, one advises a group on the list that of their responsibilities under international humanitarian law. Where would that fall? Where would you say that would fall with this decision?
Advising a designated group of its obligations.
Oh, their responsibilities under international humanitarian law, when the reason you're there is not to assist them, but to assist another party that is not on the list.
Right. Well, that this is the problem with the law, that it doesn't really care what your purpose is. Our clients had, unassailable purposes. The government didn't question them, but nonetheless, the court held that their activities could be made a crime. So if you're advising a designated terrorist group on a legal subject, that would almost certainly be construed as providing expert advice to the group. It could also be perceived as providing training to the group, and would be a crime, regardless of whether you had some other purpose in doing so.
Regardless of whether you're present with the other party, it's not on the list, and you're accompanying the other party.
Regardless of as to whether
you're accompanying another party to this conflict.
Yeah,
you're basically speaking on their behalf.
Yeah.
Your
activity.
One side. You're representing the other side.
Yes.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, and then here, this is one of the many gray areas in the law, because what the government said in the briefing in the Supreme Court is, you have a right. Well, under this law, under this law, it is not a crime to become a member of a designated foreign terrorist organization. It is also not a crime to meet and talk with a foreign terrorist organization. So you're free to go over there and talk with them. You're even free to join them. But what you're not free to do is provide them with material support, which, you know, consists of providing expert advice or training or service of some kind. And so, you know, the question, one of the arguments we made is that it's, you know, how are our clients to know where the line is drawn between talking and providing expert advice? And the government's answer is, if you're having a discussion, your answer is derived from specialized knowledge, then it's expert advice, and it becomes a crime to provide that answer. If your answer is not, so if you're, you know, I suppose if you go over there and talk about the weather and you have no expertise in weather, then you're okay. But if you talk about humanitarian law and you have expertise in humanitarian law, that could well be construed as providing expert advice to the group. Now, I will say, you know, each individual and each group has to make a decision, I suppose, about the likelihood that they're going to be prosecuted for these. And President Carter, I don't think the Carter Center is going to stop doing election monitoring, stop meeting with Hezbollah. I think President Carter's probably, may well be confident that he's not going to get prosecuted. The New York Times, I don't know how the New York Times will feel about, you know, the possibility that it might get prosecuted if it publishes an op-ed by a spokesperson for a terrorist organization. But, you know, I think individuals and groups have to make assessments about this. The government, just to be clear, the government did not prosecute my client, this former federal judge and this humanitarian law group. Rather, once it became clear that it was a crime to do what we were doing, we went to court to get the court to rule that, in fact, we had the constitutional right to do it, and so that they could do it without risking getting prosecuted. And for 12 years, the court said, that's right, you have a right to do it, but we lost in the Supreme Court.
The second question is simply, what is the parallel statute, Treasury statute, and where does one find that? What is the parallel Treasury statute, and where does one find that list?
Yeah, well, it's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act is the statute, and then it's implemented through an executive order, which is Executive Order 13224. You can Google that. And and you can go on the Treasury Department's website and look for the list of specially designated terrorists, and they change it every week. It's hundreds of pages with thousands of names.
Thank you,
Mr. Cole. I know that we had agreed to an hour. We didn't start right on time. Would you have time for one or two additional questions?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Are there questions?
Yeah, I have one. I have a couple of questions that I emailed into ACR. My name is Richard Sussman. I'm in New York City. I'm a mediator and an attorney, and I'm a former CCR intern. My first question has to do with the current proximity talks with Hamas. George Mitchell, the president's special envoy, is engaged in peace talks mediation with Hamas, a group that's on the State Department's terrorist list. Is he not providing material support to Hamas by, in paraphrasing Judge Roberts, making it more legitimate or somehow enhancing its power under the Judge Justice Roberts' definition of material support?
Yes. I mean, I think the answer is, you know, yes, and probably, you know, in the real world, different rules apply to, you know, to U.S. government initiatives and to private initiatives.
That's an interesting point, though.
I'm going to get into a sort of vague area of that. I also wanted to know whether you're aware that in May 2010, the U.S. Institute for Peace, which is a State Department affiliated agency, and I know your answer might be similar, published a report by Arlene Kurth-Conan, a professor at the National Defense University, called "When Should We Talk to Terrorists?" Are you inferring that from the humanitarian relief decision that talking to terrorists should be exclusively the province of mediators non-neutrals who represent the United States government?
Well, again, it depends on what it means to talk to terrorists. You know, one answer would be that, as the government said in the briefs in the case, you are free to talk to these groups. The trick is, and you know, is, as I said before, that if in talking to the groups you happen to provide information that is of a specialized, derives from a specialized knowledge, then you're providing them with expert advice, and you could be prosecuted. And so I think that, you know, the likely effect of the law is to preclude – well, I think the likely effects of the law are several. One is to preclude non-government entities from talking to terrorists unless they are – people who are willing to take the risk that they might be prosecuted and do it anyway, or if they're not U.S. persons. So, you know, it doesn't, you know, a British organization is free to go and provide expert advice, et cetera, and because they're not subject to this, for the most part, they're not going to be subject to this prohibition. But for Americans, a person subject to U.S. jurisdiction, it sort of takes it off the table.
Have you
professor?
Professor Cole will probably know this. Is this consistent with the congressional debate that went on in Congress when the Patriot Act was debated, if it was, especially if it was debated?
Well, what is the law and the government's interpretation of it consistent with Congress's intent? We argued before the court that the court should interpret the statute to not to make it a crime to provide aid in the form of otherwise protected speech, unless the government shows that the individual specifically intended to promote the illegal ends of the group. We argued that, and we argued that the congressional intent was consistent with that. And there is some legislative history that we cited from the initial enactment of the statute that supports that, including from Senator Hatch. Three members of the court, Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, agreed. but they were in dissent. And the majority rejected that and said that, you know, the Congress wrote the law broadly and Congress intended the law to be applied broadly. But, I think that leaves it open to the citizenry to go back to Congress and say, could you really have meant to make President Carter into a terrorist because he monitored elections in Lebanon? Do you really mean to make it a crime for newspapers to publish op-eds by an organization just because the United States has put it on a blacklist? Those kinds of questions, I think, are ones that I think it could get a favorable audience in Congress.
I thought I heard one other person trying to come in with a question.
Yeah, Professor Cole, does the legislative history and or now that the ruling has been made allow for and generate enough desire on the part of those who want to see a clarification or maybe an expression from Congress to enact something that would amend the law to address the concerns that you have elicited and stated?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think I know that there are members of Congress who are very concerned about this. There were attempts to adopt some amendments that would expand, for example, expand the kind of humanitarian aid exemption even before the decision came down. So they didn't succeed, but they were taken seriously. So I do think that there's interest among some members of Congress. You know, trying to predict what Congress will do is, as anyone who has followed it for the last decade knows, is not the wisest business to be in. But you know, my view is ultimately it is some sort of legislative amendment is attainable, but only if there is a wide, broad-based coalition that is working to educate the public about how extreme this law is, and that sort of makes its way into the halls of Congress. And as I said, the Charity and Security Network in Washington is now, you know, has been doing that work for the last couple of years, and I think that's probably right now that's the best sort of focal point for this kind of activity. And those of you who are interested, I encourage you to, you know, go to their website and contact the head of it. It is a woman named Kay Guinane, I'm sure, who you can contact through the website. And if your organization is interested in working to try to make this a more reasonable law, I think that would be important. You know, it really is. The Supreme Court has sort of had its say, and I think in the long term, one can imagine cases arising that would afford opportunities to limit the Supreme Court, the sort of bad ill effects of the Supreme Court's decision, just as happened in the Communist Party cases. But I think in the shortish to medium term, the focal point for reform is much more likely to be legislative than judicial.
Thank you.
There's sort of a fire alarm going off in the back here, but it's they're telling you it's not real, so I hope it doesn't.
Well, boy, that might be a good signal to end the call. If your building has got an alarm going. Mr. Cole, let me just say thank you so much again for giving of your time, and if there are any final words or concluding remarks you'd like to make, I'll invite you to do so. And just meanwhile, and especially since this call is being recorded, I will just say, to my knowledge and to the knowledge of everybody on ACR's board and staff, there are no designated organizations on the call today, so none of us will be prosecuted for having this conversation.
Well, that's encouraging. Well, you know, I think the mere fact that one, you know, that could be an issue, I think illustrates how really dangerous this law is. I think it's, you know, as I said, I think it's counterproductive from the point of advancing the cause of peace in the world. It's inconsistent, I think, with our fundamental commitments to free speech and free association. It's predicated on a very sort of simplistic and ill-informed view of the way political organizations operate that are engaged in conflict around the world. And I'm hopeful that this is not the end of the story. But again, it will only not be the end of the story if people who are concerned speak up and encourage their representatives to do something about it, and most importantly, work with civil society groups to educate the public and seek change. And so, those of you who are have an institutional affiliation, I encourage you to make this issue one that your organization works on, and to touch base with the Charity and Security Network to find out how you can do it in coordination with others.
Well, and I am pleased to be involved with ACR, the Association for Conflict Resolution, an organization that will create and promote discourse on topics like this. We'll continue to be discussing what it is that we as an organization can do, and trying to be in touch with like-minded peace groups in our country, and hope that we can stay in touch with you, Mr. Cole. Thank you again.
Absolutely. Okay. Bye-bye.
And thank you all for joining on the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Lou.